Hello, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of The Naturalist Capitalist. If you're a first-timer, please subscribe to the channel. I'm very excited. I have a very special guest tonight. Abby Martin is on the other end. How you doing, Abby?
Hey, Reed. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. You've been up in Alaska. I've been there, too. I love it there. I went there in 2016 with my brother. We went like all around the mainland and up the Inside Passage. I saw you're at the Matanuska Glacier. I also went there. But were you filming for your documentary up there or what was going on?
Yeah, absolutely. We were filming for the documentary. It was a pretty mind-blowing trip. I mean, Alaska is basically just a giant dumping ground for the U.S. military. So, you know, I think a lot of people think of just this untapped, pristine wilderness that's just gorgeous and, you know, full of wildlife. But when you kind of go beyond the veneer of what Alaska appears to be, it's a pretty toxic place considering the extent of pollution and the legacy of the U.S. military in the state.
So where does most of that take place? In the inland, like around Anchorage, or sorry, around Fairbanks, or where is most of that happening?
So what was crazy about it is before we went, Superfund sites are basically extremely toxic sites that are designated by the EPA as like national priorities. Like you need to clean this the fuck up because it's devastating the environment and the communities that live there. And there are like 900 out of 1300 designated Superfund sites in the US that are either currently housing military needs or have previously hosted military needs. So Alaska has like four or five, I forget what, in terms of Superfund sites. So there's four or five across the whole state. But what we found out when we got there is there's hundreds more that are not designated Superfund sites, but are as extreme in terms of the pollution that's been left. And Superfund sites, they needed to be signed off by the governor. And it's like, there's this huge political battle behind the scenes. Like no one wants the designation of a Superfund site in their state because then they have to deal with it. And so a lot of this is just swept under the rug. A lot of these communities, you know, Alaska is like 20% indigenous people who have lived in the Arctic for like thousands of years. And it's basically the brunt of it is happening and affecting these people. So they're just expendable in the eyes of the U.S. government.
Yeah, they always have been all throughout the entire country up there. Right. You're working on this documentary and it's about the pollution that the United States military puts out there. And I saw your trailer. It looks really interesting. And I'm glad you're talking about this because I talk to a lot of environmentalists. I'm a big avid hiker, outdoorsman. So I talk with a lot of people who are active in trying to protect the environment. Almost none of them ever talk about the military. So I'm really glad you're going to be doing this. But you want to just talk about why you decided to make this documentary and what the details of it are going to be about?
Yeah, Reed, it's really cool to hear you say that because I'm an avid environmentalist as well. Like I love camping. I love hiking. I feel like our national park system here in the U.S. is unmatched anywhere in the world. It's really just incredible to be a part of nature, to understand that we come from nature and how important it is to maintain nature. And so it's just shocking that, you know, you can ask 100 people in the streets and maybe one would say that, you know, a large contributor to the environmental catastrophe that we're facing is the U.S. military, because it's kind of this tacitly endorsed notion to be an American citizen. You have to just kind of fundamentally accept the fact that we're a global empire and that it's all done for good reasons, right? We're a benevolent empire because we'd rather be the empire than, let's say, China or whatever. You know, the reasons go on and on. They're just endless insanity to justify what we're doing around the world. But it's coupled with just this toxic legacy. Like, you know, you could talk about the environment all day because it really is endless in terms of the militarism that is destroying the planet. But like, you know, let's say that you don't care about the environment. Like you care about human life, right? Because the military has callous disregard for human life as well. And there's countless examples of just intentional dumping of forever chemicals that are called PFAS and hundreds of sites clandestinely across the US that are happening right now. This isn't just legacies and remnants of the Cold War and World War II of like nuclear chemicals that have also been dumped in creek beds and saturated groundwater in hundreds of sites across the country. So basically the crux of the film is that it's an anti-imperialist intervention in the environmentalist movement, because I'm as confused as you are. I don't understand how it is possible that climate change and that environmentalism is on the forefront of a lot of people's minds. It is, you know, it's in the consciousness of not only the American people, but of course the global community. And yet militarism, not just the US, but the junior collaborators of the empire, all these people who are part of these climate summits, completely absolve and immunize the United States military as well as every other country's military. So it's just kind of ludicrous when you're taking a step back and saying, what are we actually talking about here if we're not pointing out the major contributor and main culprit to this destruction?
So do you think that's just the influence that the military has, or do you think environmentalism can be sort of a social fad and a lot of people don't actually care? They're just, you know, doing it to be in the movement or whatever, because I know people like that in every movement. But why do you think it is that it's just ignored so much?
Yeah, man, I think it's exactly what you said. I mean, on one hand, it's just kind of like the anti-war movement when Bush was in office, and it was just kind of a fad. It was trendy. It was hot to just like be anti-Bush and be anti-Iraq war. And then all of a sudden he's rehabilitated in the fact that he's a war, mass murdering war criminals, forgotten about. And people are like, oh, he's a cute old sage who's good friends with Ellen. And it's like, no, this guy's a fucking murderer. He deserves to be in a dungeon. And so it's this historical amnesia wrapped and coupled with that notion that, you know, it's the political partisanship. But when you're pointing it like specifically at the environmental movement, I mean, I know that people in Greenpeace and like World Wildlife Fund and all these organizations, like they have to know, right? They have to see what we see. So the only thing that I can think of is that a lot of these organizations depend on actual government grants and like government figures and access. You know, I lived in DC for 4 years. I know exactly how this shit works. Like you pay, you go along to get along. Like you know exactly who you need to suck up to get the access. It's access journalism, just like it's access for these NGOs and organizations who claim to care about the environment. But really, when you dig a little deeper, there's certain things that they just simply will not touch. So it has to be explained by that. Also, it's controversial. You know, it's controversial to actually confront something that is subversive, right? Something that actually fundamentally defines this country and probably the donor bases of a lot of these organizations. People would be offended. You know, that's the thing, is like, we're past that point. We need to talk about this issue. It's gone on far too long and we are running out of time, Reed. And so as much as I hear people talking about paper straws and whatever, it's exactly the same as every other issue. It's been individualized in our era of neoliberalism, where the onus is on us to somehow solve the environmental problems of the world. Meanwhile, Coca-Cola is dumping like millions of plastic bottles in the ocean. Like, it's absurd to think that if we take less showers or drive a Prius, we're going to solve this. And that's exactly what the propaganda campaign is designed to do. So I forgot to plug the actual movie itself. It's called Earth's Greatest Enemy. And you can check it out at earthsgreatestenemy.com. We're in the midst of a fundraising drive to really see how big we can really map out the project that we want to do.
So there's probably no release date on it yet then, if you're still figuring out how big it's going to be? Or
yeah, first we're like, okay, should we go to the territorial empire, Guam, Puerto Rico? Like, because those, you know, Puerto Rico has a whole section of it that's just used as a bombing range that has been completely decimated. So it's like, we could do that. And then there's the broader global empire, where Okinawa, you know, which is one giant military base, Jeju Islands, which is being decimated, these pristine habitats, the blue coral reef, unmatched anywhere else in the world, these geoparks. And so there's so many things that we can document. And then as well as the anti-militarist struggles in those regions, which are militant, which are incredible. I mean, people have been doing it for decades. And so to document that and to document people really putting their bodies on the line to demilitarize their communities is something that we really hope to do. But again, like, all this shit just costs so much money because we're really trying to make it as professional as possible. And I have quite a bit of OCD when it comes to the work that I do. So it really is meticulous and it has to be very good looking in every way. So that costs a lot of money, man.
Yeah. Well, I look forward to seeing that when it comes out. I'm excited for that. As far as the military goes, you know, I was shocked that Biden actually pulled the ground troops out of Afghanistan. I didn't think that was going to happen. But, I mean, what's mind-boggling to me is there are still boomer cons who want troops on the ground everywhere. Like, we haven't evolved past that. They, you know, Lindsey Graham, you know, Mitch McConnell, people like that, they're always, Liz Cheney, they're always going to want boots on the ground. But even if we somehow evolve beyond that point, the war on terrorism is evolving. Like, it's not going to be about invading countries anymore. I mean, it's going to be targeted drone strikes that kill children and radicalize people to terrorism. But this, like, even in Afghanistan, even though we've left, they're talking about the over the horizon approach, which is definitely not leaving. Like, we're still going to be drone bombing the shit out of that place and suppressing terrorism. So do you think that is going to be less visible to people when we start fighting war completely that way instead of boots on the ground? Because I don't feel like anyone even knows about the over the horizon approach of Afghanistan. No normal person who's not paying attention to politics like we do has any idea that's going on.
Yeah, I mean, it is dangerous because, again, this is a notion that's just been completely accepted, and we've been conditioned to normalize this endless war on terrorism that's now 20 years ongoing. And even someone like Tulsi Gabbard, who was the quote-unquote anti-war candidate, the anti-regime change candidate, even she was just recently endorsing that drone strike that wiped out an entire family.
Yep.
I mean, that is a really horrific kind of state of affairs that we're living in, where even Bernie Sanders, I mean, both of them accept drone strikes as somehow the necessary solution to fight terrorism around the world. Where did this come from? It's lunacy. All it does, as you mentioned, is further radicalize these communities where it is terrorism. You're terrorizing civilians, and it kills 90% at least civilians, you know? And so, yes, I think it's very dangerous now that we're moving out of the ground troops, which I completely endorse. Of course, ending wars is a good thing. But as you mentioned, this isn't really the end of the war. The war continues. The war has been continuing in several countries for decades, and it's going to keep expanding. I mean, it's mind-boggling to think of what is going on a day-to-day basis with special operations and special forces in countries like Somalia, Yemen. We already know that the aiding and abetting of the genocide in Yemen is still continuing, right? It's just the rhetoric has changed, Biden's posturing has changed, and people just kind of fall asleep. I mean, I don't get it. Like, you know, it's just shocking. I mean, it's been 20 years of this, and I just don't understand what it will take for people to wake up to the fact that this is not okay, for people to care about the lives of children halfway across the world that our policies are literally murdering on a daily basis. I don't understand it. I mean, I ask myself this every day, where is the international solidarity? Why do you only care about migrants being caged at the border, but you don't care about the people that are, you know, living under the coups and dictatorships and overthrows and bombs and drone strikes? And it's really sad because I think that is a tactic that is put into place for this very reason, out of sight, out of mind, right? Fight them over there so they don't come over here. Just like the stop loss program during the Iraq and Afghanistan troop surges and stuff was kind of like the backdoor draft, because they learned from Vietnam, and now they learned from the two ground wars that they basically lost strategically. And so now they're just going to continue drone strikes to try to keep quote-unquote extremists at bay, when we both know, and I'm sure a lot of your viewers know, that it only exacerbates terrorism. I mean, look at like the statistics around the world of how much global terrorism has increased in the wake of 9/11. It's astronomical. So really, what is going on here? It's obviously not solving the problem. So it's really just putting, you're just lining the coffers of defense contractors at this point. And it's just hilarious that is literally who is calling the shots and who is profiting from this endless expansion.
Yeah. You know, over the last several years, when I actually started paying attention to what was going on, I started noticing that we kind of kowtow to two countries in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia and Israel. And you don't really get a lot of flack for criticizing Saudi Arabia And, you know, most Americans, if you ask them what they think about Saudi Arabia, if they even know what country it is, they'll probably not have a positive opinion of it. But Israel, on the other hand, like, holy crap. I mean, even the short amount of time that I've been visible in politics, like, I get so much flack for criticizing Israel. I get called a Jew hater, anti-Semitic, whatever. And I've literally only ever criticized the government of Israel for what they're doing to the Palestinian people. And I don't even get into like domestic policies with Israel. I could, but I don't even talk about it. I just talk about, hey, it's wrong that you're ethnically cleansing the natives of that area. But you used to be a Zionist a long time ago, right? And then you changed your mind over time. How did that take place?
Well, I didn't even know what Palestine was when I was growing up. Like, it's crazy the mass conditioning and propaganda that we literally grow up indoctrinated to believe that Israel is like an extension of this country. Like, I just thought Israel can do no wrong. Israel's our greatest ally. We just saw all these like kind of myths that you just accept without questioning anything during your education system. And I grew up in a suburb in the Bay Area, and I just like didn't think anything of it. I didn't even know what Palestine was at all. Like, of course you hear it in the background, oh, Israel, Palestine. I mean, basically I think a lot of people don't really understand that Israel was created on top of another country, you know, and that they are continuing to ethnically cleanse the indigenous population. And it's literally like a continuous expulsion, a settler colonialism. And so once you realize that, you're like, oh my God, this isn't just like warring countries or peoples who just can't get along. And it's just a tale as old as time in terms of like religious differences. No, it couldn't be more extreme or more obvious and blatant, right? Like, people are like, oh, it's the most complicated issue in the world. It's like, actually, it's one of the most straightforward ones. You've just been so heavily indoctrinated with propaganda that you actually don't understand how not complicated it is. But I remember when I was in college, that's when I first like took a Mideast studies class, like when I was a freshman, and I was like, oh my God, like this is actually not what I thought it was. And then, you know, I remember a really just horrific moment of realization, I think, like knowing, I think going back to 9/11, actually, it was always kind of coupled with the anti-Arab propaganda. Like, I don't know how old you were on 9/11, Reed, but I remember the footage that AP Newswire sent out, or Reuters, of the dancing Palestinians in the street, right? And it was just played over and over and over again and conflated essentially with Al-Qaeda, with terrorism. I remember Israeli prime minister going on TV that day saying, now you guys can have your war on terror just like we have ours. And basically just saying, like, we have the blueprint for you guys to roll out everything that you need to do. And you had prominent neoconservative figures like Don Kagan on C-SPAN saying, now we need to invade Gaza. And it's like, what is going on here? Like, how does this have anything to do with the attacks that just happened today? So like, looking back on it, it is really crazy how constructed the anti-Palestinian narrative was, like in relation to the hysterical wake of propaganda after 9/11. But then I think the really deciding moment for me of realizing how the media was super complicit in it, like in a cartoonish way, was the Flotilla massacre. That I'll never forget. I mean, it made no sense. The fact that Israeli commandos just commandeered a boat in international waters and just like executed like 12 peace activists who were completely unarmed, bringing wheelchairs and stuff to Gaza. And the media covered for them. They were like, these people on the boat, look, they're attacking these soldiers. They had like, they were defending themselves with like chairs because they just saw people get executed in front of them for no reason. And I was like, okay, this is like way too crazy. Like, I can't even wrap my mind around how obvious this is. And that, and ever since then, it just continued to get worse. I mean, that was before like the 2014 massacre and then the, you know, Great March of Return. And it just continued to just be more blatant of how just absurd the corporate media treats Israel, you know?
Yeah. So you went over there in 2016 to make your documentary Gaza Fights for Freedom, right? Was that 2016 or 17?
So 2016, we were over there doing a series of documentaries for Empire Files. So you can check out, there's a huge playlist on our channel called Reporting from Palestine. But while I was there, I tried to get into Gaza. Mm-hmm. And we were there for over a month, and it was insane. There's so many just horror stories of, you know, what we saw firsthand that we documented. But we tried to get into Gaza, and I filled out all the proper paperwork and had the press credentials, but I was told that I was a propagandist, not a journalist, and I was also an Iranian spy the Israeli press ministry. And I was like, okay, that's actually really scary and weird that you would say that. I'm used to being called a Russian spy or a Venezuelan agent. I was like, where did Iran come from? So anyway, we got the hell out of there. But fast forward to the Great March of Return, I knew that I was like banned for life from getting into Gaza. So when the Great March of Return happened, and I was like, the media is doing such an abysmal job at covering this, and no one's really doing their due diligence, like really putting the story in the proper perspective. And so that's when I talked to my colleagues in Gaza, and I was like, we need to do something in collaboration together. And so we hired the team who got that incredible footage. I mean, it really is mind blowing what they did.
Yeah, that's a very good documentary. Anyone who doesn't know anything about this, I would suggest you start there. And I have Empire Files linked in the description, and go look up Gaza Fights for Freedom. If you don't know anything about what we're talking about, just go watch that documentary. It's amazing. It's very good.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, like you said, you have an eye for perfection when you're making these videos. It's very, very good. I've watched it twice.
So. Oh, that's amazing, dude. I really appreciate that. People can check it out on our YouTube channel. It's for free, and who knows how long it'll be up there. It's already been heavily suppressed, but I really appreciate you, the plug, and I appreciate you watching it, man. I mean, it's heavy, but it's also like, this is reality and this is what we're funding. And people do need to open their eyes to the horrors that are happening, you know?
Yeah. So what type of social media, like crunches do you have to deal with? Like, what do they go after mostly?
So when I was at RT, a year after I left RT was when the DNI report came out, which was the 17 intelligence agencies that definitively declared that like Trump basically engineered himself to be president or whatever.
Right.
And I know that the like algorithm had already changed before that, and there was a lot of suppression on behalf of big tech going on, but that was like when things really shifted and when it just became completely insane. Like everyone who had built up YouTube channels just were getting blatantly suppressed. The DNI report actually pointed to my show as part of the intelligence operation on behalf of Russia to engineer and manufacture like discord and sow discontent among the American public, and basically like helped get Trump into office. I was part of this hysterical intelligence narrative that was then just mindlessly parroted by everyone, which was so insane because it's like people would just parrot that DNI report, but then when you actually read it, it was very bad. It made no sense. And the fact that I was drawn up into it was just like proved how absurd it was, because I never once talked about Trump. All I did was talk about things that the American people cared about. That's why at that time, a lot of people were watching RT, because they were doing things that the corporate media was failing at. They were covering third parties. They were, you know, covering things like libertarianism, you know. And I remember hosting a debate with like a socialist, a libertarian, and an anarchist, which is like, when would you ever see that in corporate media? So just doing things like that do essentially threaten corporate media hegemony and the status quo and stuff like that. But they just had no choice but to just paint with a broad brush like all of Russia today as part of this sinister plot by Putin himself. So I know firsthand how insane it can get, because I was part of that. But I did also witness firsthand the suppression. I mean, my show, Empire Files, we used to sell it to Telesur, which is a Latin American conglomerate, and U.S. sanctions shut that down. So it's been a long road of, you know, big tech curating our reality, sanitizing it for us, and telling us what we can and can't see. And it's just going to get worse. And it has been getting worse steadily. And it's very dangerous, because when you designate people and delegate them to other lanes of reality, it just further validates their own worldview and silos ourselves off from each other, when in reality, we need to be having conversations together. We all need to be on these platforms. I feel like it's the public commons. I mean, it's absurd that this is where we are with these tech giants, but I don't see a way out of it other than to go back to how we used to organize, like, and, you know, out in the streets, because it's definitely being monitored and surveilled and controlled online, which is just sad, but I guess inevitable.
Yeah, it's funny too. Like, you see people begging for censorship and begging for shutting people down that they don't like. And, you know, then when it ends up coming around to them, they're like, oh my God. I mean, I remember when Trump was running in 2016, he was saying we need to shut down certain parts of the internet. And he even said, like, you can say free speech, you can say whatever you want, but we have terror, you know, like domestic, or he didn't say domestic at that time, but it was terrorist organizations that we need to keep an eye on. Then you just fast forward to the beginning of 2021 and they remove him from all his platforms. And then they're targeting Republicans as domestic terrorists. And it's just like, you know, it's just amazing to watch how that cycle works. And I don't know. I mean, people just beg for it. And then the other thing is, like, I love the CIA woke ad that they put out, and like all these giant corporations embracing wokeism as if they're on our side or something. And people just gobble it up. I mean, and it's so obviously fake, but I don't know. I guess people just don't think anymore. I don't really know why they're so susceptible to it. Why do you think?
I mean, I think our society is, like, unraveling. I think that we're losing our collective minds, and it gets worse. I mean, as time goes on, I think it's getting worse and worse, where we're no longer able to constructively engage with each other. I mean, I think honestly, it is in part due to what I was just talking about, like the siloing off and the echo chambers that we're reinforcing to ourselves with social media and the algorithms is actually, like, really damaging just dialogue. I think that is honestly one of the main culprits. Another one, of course, but this is, like, kind of part and parcel with that, is just corporate media. You know, when you have, like, five corporations controlling over 90% of everything that we're engaging with on a daily basis, like, it really does dictate what reality is. And it tells you what the acceptable parameters are for free speech, for discussion, for intellectualism. And it's just, it is just really sad, because the vast majority of people just unquestioningly follow these rules, right? And they watch MSNBC and they watch Fox News and they just go online and engage with their Facebook memes, and they just never question the man behind the curtain, the entities behind the curtain, who is dictating what is or what is not fake news, like on Facebook, you know, like, who is the Atlantic Council? What agencies are involved in that? You really peel back the layers here, and it actually is very disturbing, you know, and all these people are working in concert with each other. And when you look at who's actually getting censored, yeah, it's a lot of people on the right, and it's also a lot of people on the left. It's a lot of people who are questioning authority, a lot of people who are questioning narratives that are put out by the mainstream. And that is very, very disturbing. It's a lot of, like, Chinese state media, Venezuela. It's always, like, designated U.S. enemy accounts and the people who follow them and maybe engage with that kind of narrative. And it's always like, oh, they're Chinese agents, they're Iranian agents. And so they were just purged. Like, you'll just see a headline that's like, thousands of accounts on Twitter were just taken off. It's like, what? Yeah. You know, it's always the people who don't go along with the U.S. and it never affects U.S. allies at all. But yeah, it's really sad when liberals cheer this on, because they don't understand that the gauntlet is going to come down on them. You know, if you just give more power to these entities to just continue to dictate who they can and can't purge, that's a really slippery slope. And I've never agreed with that. And I never will. And again, it goes back to the mind-boggling nature of how people can just endorse such a thing, not realizing the bigger picture, whether it's U.S. military contributing to most of the destruction on Earth, or the fact that censorship is not good and it will never be good. And it doesn't matter if, you know, if you hate Alex Jones, like, that's not the point. The point is that look at where we are now.
Yeah.
Like, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's weird to me. It doesn't seem like, you know, the right is good when the left is in charge, or the left is good when the right's in charge anymore. It kind of seemed like that under Bush and Obama. Like, you had some really good anti-war right wingers under Obama, and then you had some really good anti-war left wingers under Bush. But then when Trump got in, like, I just felt like the left went insane and just didn't do anything. Like, they just bought into identity politics. And now I feel like the right has kind of done the same thing. They've also bought into identity politics. Like, they're talking about Dr. Seuss and Mr. Potato Head getting banned or whatever. And I'm like, who gives a fuck? Like, why are you guys focusing on that? But I don't know. You know, I think that's probably because of what you're talking about. Like, we've just been conditioned to not look outside our echo chambers. Like, I'm supposed to think that you are evil, even though we've agreed on pretty much everything we've been talking about so far, you know, and like, I'm not supposed to talk to you because you're on the other side or whatever. It's just so dumb because, I mean, even if we did disagree on everything, we're both humans. And the only way that I'm going to find out if I'm wrong or you're going to find out if you're wrong is if we talk to each other and try to figure out what the truth is. But that's just gone. Like, no one gives a shit about that anymore.
It's so sad. It's such a sad state of affairs because that's the only way that actual change can happen is if we build coalitions, if we work together on certain issues that we can agree upon. And I'm not, you know, a lot of people have posed the question, like, can we, me as a leftist, like, can we work with the right wing? And it's like, well, how right wing are we talking about here? Why does it have to immediately revert to, like, right, Nazis and all these people? It's like, there's plenty of people who are just conservative leaning or plenty of people who are libertarians who actually can agree with a lot of what we're talking about here. But it's just weird that this has been kind of captured into this other argument, you know, that no one, I don't know. I mean, you can go off and spiral out on that, but I agree with you. I mean, I have plenty of conservative relatives. I have plenty of people who are libertarians that are in, you know, my worldview that I feel like I can relate to. And it's a detriment to the cause of anti-imperialism if we are not able to have these discussions and advance the ideas outside of the bubbles that we just constantly preach to. You know, it's exhausting. It's exhausting to just constantly feel like you're not reaching people outside of, you know, the people that already give a shit about this. And yeah, I mean, I'm a total advocate of going outside and, like, actually meeting members of the community, finding out that the people who may be demonized online or on the media, like, there, a lot of them are just normal people. I meet people all the time, workers, people who are my neighbors who have surprising beliefs, right? But I feel like I can engage with them on a human level and relate to them and understand how they've gotten to where they are. And when you're online, it's a lot harder to do that. And it's a lot easier to just judge and write people off completely.
Yeah. Well, I really want to thank you for joining me. I know you got to run. You're one of my heroes, honestly. Like, I've been following you for a couple years, and I just love people who, on it, you know, obviously actually stand for something, because that's so rare. Yeah. So much respect for so many people over the last year and a half that I used to really look up to and kind of listen to as, you know, sort of guides for what you're supposed to do. And they've just completely folded and thrown all their principles away. But I think you're great. So I've got your Twitter page linked and your YouTube page linked in the description, but where else can people follow you and keep up with you and help you in what you're doing?
I mean, thank you, Reed. I have about five more minutes, so I can definitely, I kind of wanted to go off on a tangent about the Trump stuff too, because I forgot to talk about that. I couldn't agree more with you. I've, you know, people say, like, Trump derangement syndrome, like, broke a lot of people's brains. Sure. But it broke a fuckload of people's brains on the other side too, where it was like a cult. I mean, it was really weird because I was just kind of, like, sitting back looking at, you know, doing the same things that I've been covering forever, which is militarism, war, anti-imperialism, empire. And I was like, okay, Trump is literally ramping up every single war that he adopted, tripling drone strikes, doubling civilian casualties, going on a pretty sadistic rampage, bombing the shit out of them, killing terrorists and their families like he so proudly gloated before he got in office.
We don't use our nukes enough, as Elsie said, I think, on the campaign trail.
Yeah. I mean, he literally said he wanted to kill Assange, like, on Fox and Friends, like, before, you know, he had Assange arrested. But you had this whole swath of people who, a lot of them, I was kind of allies with back during the Bush administration. You know, a lot of us were organizing together. It was kind of the broader Occupy Wall Street movement that arose out of the anti-war movement.
And then all of a sudden, I see a lot of these people kind of following the marching orders of Donald Trump. And so, yes, liberals became hysterical. They thought Putin engineered the election. They never blamed the Democratic Party. They never wanted to enlist any accountability for how we got Trump. Trump is a natural evolution of this country. He's a reality TV star. He's a land. Like, there are so many things about Trump. It's like, yeah, obviously that's why that happened. But people literally could not accept reality. And so they had to blame a foreign country. And it's to our detriment. Again, like, we're children. You know, we can't grasp like the reality and we can't deal with it. So we just revert to this magical thinking. But a lot of people on the other side became cult-like worshipers of Donald Trump, literally thinking that this man was fighting the deep state, that he was anti-globalist, that he was going to pardon Assange and pardon Snowden, that he was going to withdraw all the troops from everywhere. He was going to end the empire. He was going to stand up to the military-industrial complex. He was going to expose 9/11. Like, the list goes on and on. And I felt like I was watching kind of two sides just spiral out of control, because I just couldn't believe it. And sad to say, I really did lose respect for a lot of people during that time, because I just couldn't believe the dishonesty that was being peddled. Blame it on the algorithm, blame it on feeding, you know, the audience, I guess. But like, that's not how I roll. And I was just like, what is going on here? This is not okay. How are so little people commenting on like the war crimes that Trump is doing? And that was my whole thing. And the whole time I just felt like a lone voice in the wilderness being like, dude, Trump's bad. And he's like committing war crimes all the time. And people were like, ugh, like constantly just going to bat for him. So I'll never fucking forget that, man. And I'm glad people are all focused on hating Biden and shit. Like, we need to, you know, we need to blame, you know, the commander in chief and his cabinet for sure, because they have a lot of power, executive power, especially when it comes to militarism. But like, letting Trump off the hook was just an unforgettable thing. And we need to really take stock of how that happened.
Yeah. Well, I didn't have a very loud voice because I didn't have a large audience, but I was one of the other people out there doing that too. My viewers who have been with me a while, they can attest to that. But I actually left the Republican Party in 2018 because I was just done. Like, I used to be in the Republican Party, and
really,
they didn't care about, you know, any of the good thing, because I always knew they sucked. Like, we had George Bush and John McCain and Mitt Romney. I mean, so yeah, obviously they sucked. But it was like, well, they talk about freedom and small government, and you know, to me that meant like small militaries, you know, like keeping the intelligence agencies at bay. But they just like didn't do any of that. It was all culture war shit, and they just kept expanding the government, like the bad parts of the government, all over the place. I was just like, all right, I'm done with this. And like you said, like Trump, it was weird because the criticisms of him were stupid from the left mostly. They're just like, they didn't land, but that didn't mean there weren't actual evil things he was doing. So I was one of the few people trying to point out, like you pointed out, like all the drone strikes and, you know, ramping up the wars, and then toward the end of his term, even like freeing war criminals instead of Julian Assange. Like, it's a disaster.
In the Source Square massacre, guys, it's like, are you kidding me? Like, these are the most horrific war criminals, and it's insane that he did that. I mean, what a disgusting legacy to leave behind, like literally freeing the very few service members, sadistic motherfuckers who like tortured Iraqis and stuff, and like, I mean, the desecration of corpses and all that. And then he just frees them. And it's like, wow. Like, that's honestly how we should remember Trump. Freeing the war criminals and all the horrific stuff he did abroad. Because it really is disturbing, Reed. Yeah. It really is. Yeah. I'm really happy you're talking. I'm happy you left the Republican Party, man. That's great.
Yeah, I encourage everybody to do that. But
asking, how old are you?
27. So.
Okay, so yeah, you... Yeah, no, that makes sense. I mean, we all had that moment, right? I'm embarrassed to say that I actually went on a swing state trip for Kerry back in 2004 before I realized that he was a monster and the Democratic Party was terrible. You know, it's like you kind of have to reach that breaking point to realize it's a big club and you ain't in it, no matter how hard you try.
Exactly. I talk about it all the time because I try to show people, like, you know, I was a neocon originally. Like, I was brought up like in the far right evangelical, Israel can do no wrong. We need to bomb the terrorists into submission. You know, that was that was my upbringing. So anyone can change. And, you know, I just, it's only through talking to each other though, like you and I are. So hopefully people continue to do that.
Yeah, I totally agree. Thank you so much, Reed, for having me on. I really appreciate it. And I enjoyed the conversation. I appreciate it, man.